You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to and watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz, and today is April 21st, 2021. Well, gold looks like it's getting ready to make its move. If you've been listening to the show, you've heard a number of our experts, particularly cycle people, saying that May was going to be the month. And normally it's sell in May and go away, but perhaps not this year. And that would be an interesting anomaly, a big change from what's usually happening, what usually happens in the markets this time of year. We've also seen gold the past couple of years take off during summer months. So that's a bit of a transition. And then sometimes the end of the year, gold being a little bit listless, perhaps going up a bit, but not hitting highs. If you remember last summer, it was August 7th, gold hit its all-time high. So with us, our good friend, Lobo Tigre, formerly known as Louis James, and it's great to have you back here, Lobo. So you're pretty bullish about gold, aren't you?
I am, but it makes me wonder why you have your background set to make you look deep underwater. You know, sure, we're a little underwater compared to last summer, but you know, that was a rally and some correction was certainly to be expected. I know gold bugs, you know, that they hate hearing, you know, buying opportunity. They're sick of buying opportunities. They don't want buying opportunities. They want gold to go up. But you know what? Mr. Market doesn't care what we want. It does what it does. And if our fundamental thesis, which I'm sure most of the audience shares with you and me, Carrie, is correct, then you know nothing has changed. Prices are down. That's a buying opportunity. So I'm perfectly happy to see it turning around. You know, sell in May and go away certainly wasn't the answer last year. And the same phenomenon and same money printing could certainly make it a very profitable time to be buying this year.
So true. So true. And yeah, I don't know if you call it a correction or a consolidation or whether the two are one and the same or not, but it never really went down that low. And then until last month, it went below 1700 and it made what one of my guests calls a W pattern, which is perhaps one of the most powerful chart formations, if you believe in such things.
Let me ask you, I see these things and I hear people talking about this double bottom and they say, oh, this is really bullish. And then I say, how bullish? What do you mean by that? Like, tell me, in 60% of the cases where there's a W like this, it goes up, or 51, even 51 would be something, you know, 75 would be great. You know, what, how bullish is that? And I'm not putting you on the spot particularly, Carrie. I'm just saying I've heard this a lot and I'm a bull. I'm not trying to argue against it.
Sure.
But nobody can give me a number. I want a number. If I'm going to buy because of a double bottom, then I want to know what percentage of the time that double bottom is actually a bullish sign. And I've never seen a number on that backed by any kind of data other than, oh, I just think it's bullish.
Well, the guy who I follow very closly, do a daily show with him, is a guy by the name of Nick Santiago. And he's researched these things back 100 plus years. So, it doesn't always work and they can break down. Any pattern can break down. There's no guarantees.
But does he have a number? Does Nick say like 62% of the time this double bottom means it's going up?
Going to ask him because I never thought
okay. So while we're thinking about that, here's the thing is I looked at that and I noticed it like everybody else and I'm hoping it's a bullish sign. I just don't want to think that I know that it's a bullish sign. And the other thing is like, another frequently cited pattern is the head and shoulders. And the implication of the head and shoulders is that if you go over the head and you get up to the second shoulder, well, that's bearish. It's going down. And you could look at this double bottom now as the after the head shoulder. There's a similar support level, people say, on the other side of last year's peak. But if these are shoulders, this is actually bearish, right? And I'm not saying that. I'm not a bear. I'm just saying that these technical patterns that people talk about all the time, I never know what to do with them.
He actually mentioned that. He said that head and shoulders pattern formed, but then it broke down. And that's another case for bullishness. I can only look at the charts and see squiggles and lines. if I could read them like others, like Nick Santiago, I'd be doing it. So I got to follow the people. And a goodly portion of the time, they're right. One thing people were expecting was a major pullback in the stock markets. And there's certain technical formations happening there. Hasn't happened yet. Right. So you can't follow the chart patterns as if they were a Bible and or hard and fast black letter law. But what you can do is follow them, and it's an indicator, right? Like any other indicator. And then you can see where they go from there.
Sure. And I got to say, despite my head and shoulders pushback there, you know, with gold within kissing distance of 1800 now, as you and I speak, that doesn't look like the next shoulder down. That really looks like we're leaving that head and shoulders thesis behind. So I'm very optimistic, but I'm an optimist on a fundamental basis. You look at all that money printing coming, you look at the infrastructure, you know, phase one, these initial trillions of the infrastructure, all the money printing has already been done. The Fed keeping the needle stuck on easy forever, it seems. It's really hard to see how in this kind of context anybody should be bearish on monetary metals.
And you know, a lot of people look though, Lobo, and they say, well, look what's happened with Bitcoin and gold and silver have done nothing. I know people who sold all of their metals and put them all into cryptos, and they're very happy with the results, obviously. But what's your take on that? Cryptos are the new gold and the new precious metals? Are we really looking at that?
No. So, all right, several things. We could have a very long conversation about that. Let me try to pick a few of the more important ones. One, I reject the thesis that it's gold versus Bitcoin. Both are alternatives to the dollar. If you smooth out the noise, the short-term noise, you look at the long-term moving averages, it turns out that gold and Bitcoin have moved together almost all the time. I don't have a number. It's like 90% of the time since Bitcoin's inception, which actually makes sense with both being alternatives to the dollar, given what's happened to the dollar over the years. So I think the overall idea is wrong. And I think it's very wrong-headed for on both sides for people, you know, gold bugs to be lavishing hate on the Bitcoin crowd or the opposite. I think the Bitcoin crowd has done gold a huge favor by educating entire generations who would never have paid attention to gold or silver before about the dangers of fiat currencies. So, you know, maybe in some future world where the fiats have gone the way of the dodo, then we can have a debate about whether gold or Bitcoin is better money. And my answer to that would just be let the market decide. That having been said, clearly, you know, momentum chasing capital has gone into whatever, as it always does, you know, whatever is giving the most yield right now. And the example you gave of some people selling gold and buying Bitcoin, they're happy now. I hope they realize some of those gains. I hope they're not happy now and sad tomorrow. But actually, I've asked my readers about this, and I have two that I know of out of almost 10,000 who have said that they have sold gold and gone into cryptos instead. And I don't think that Bitcoin is eating gold's lunch. I think it's adding to the table. And sure, some capital, momentum chasing capital that would have gone into gold if it was shining now instead of Bitcoin, hasn't. But, you know, we saw last year that money's perfectly happy to go into gold and silver when they are shining. So I just don't see why this needs to be one or the other, some big fight. Yeah. And probably enough said. Those are the main points. I think that they can coexist. And I think ultimately it will be up to the market to decide. And I don't think that when the gold bull wants to run, that somehow Bitcoin is going to defuse it or kill it or derail it.
I couldn't agree with you more because some have theorized or postulated that what's been keeping gold down is the broader stock market going up. A lot more people invested there. There's no fear. There's complacency.
Right. Gold is a safe haven, right? So if it's happy, happy, joy, joy on Wall Street, what do you need a safe haven for? Yeah. No, I get that. And The thing, though, is that that safe haven aspect is really only part of it. It's a safe haven if you look at gold as a commodity only. But if you think of it as a monetary phenomenon, as money, as an alternative to the dollar, well, then that whole narrative really doesn't matter. You look at what's happening with interest rates and real rates, which have always, since gold was decoupled from the dollar, have always had a very strongly negative relationship with gold. And it explains a lot of what's been going on. People don't like it when I say this, but it's true. You just look at the charts, look at them on, particularly on a daily day basis and even intraday basis. There's nothing that moves quite, you know, as opposite to the gold price as interest rates. You know, the 10-year and the price of gold, or like I like to call it, the gold-dollar exchange rate, they're like a Rorschach image of each other on a day-to-day basis with very few exceptions. So the no safe haven demand argument just completely ignores the most overwhelming data we have now. And in fact, as you and I speak, gold's up while rates are down. That's happening right now. You know, who cares about safe haven demand when that's what's going on?
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying. And yeah, there's no hard and fast rules here. It's kind of when the gold is ready to go, it'll go, and it'll take silver with it, and silver will go ahead of it. I mean, we know that. But right. There's another play here, and that is the whole resource sector in general. And I'm not one of these people that believes we're going to run out of everything. But what we've seen because of the cyclicality nature of resources is we go through these phases where investment in production and discovery and new mines, and we see it really clearly in copper, they go down, and then something affects demand and we don't have enough, and then the money pours into the sector. I mean, look at copper, Loba. What's your take on copper? Because not a monetary metal, a strict commodity, but everything that they're pushing with the Green New Deal, the green agenda, and electrification, some of which I do agree with, because in theory, at least, electrical supplies of electrical energy are more efficient than others. Reality doesn't quite always work that way. But nonetheless, in its finite wisdom, the powers that be, the government of the world, have determined that.
I agree with you. There's a lot of people when we talk about this at Carry that want to say, oh, you know, it's all because of subsidies. You know, it shouldn't be bad, bad, bad. Well, I agree with that. I'm a libertarian. I hate subsidies, but they are there. It doesn't matter whether I hate them or not. As you say, the powers that be have decided to make it so. It's happening, whether it should happen the way it's happening or not. It is. But that being said, it almost even that doesn't matter. Copper is called Dr. Copper for a reason. It's fundamental to the modern economy anyway. So this whole electrification, or we should say additional electrification and electric cars and so on, the new energy paradigm is on top of copper being an essential cornerstone of the economy, which goes to what you're earlier saying about supply issues and that. Now, I have to say I haven't done my own research on this recently in terms of the latest numbers. That's a big project to actually go out there and dig into all the supply and demand around the world. But you look at reputable outfits like Macquarie, Wood Mackenzie, and so on, you know, reputable engineering firms that do this sort of thing, as well as some of the other authors out there, I expect, contrary to my arrogant reputation, there are actually some other newsletter writers and writer authors out there whose opinions I respect and whose judgment I respect. You look at this, and the consensus is very, not only to say consensus, it's almost unanimous, that we're looking at serious structural supply shortages in the copper market, no matter what. And then you add the EV thing on top of that, and it just puts it on steroids. There was an article I saw recently, and again, I didn't do this math myself, but they're saying if you take the sort of the median projections for EV adoptions and you put that on top of the regular industrial demand for copper, we need something like 6 more Ivanhoes a year going forward. You know what I mean? So, I mean, for anybody who's not twigging what I'm saying, but they have this monster copper project they're bringing online now in the DRC, just absolutely world-class. One of the biggest, highest grades, just amazing copper projects out there. And, you know, it's single-handedly will be a large source of copper in the entire global marketplace. And that sounds like, wow, well, you got these new giant mines coming on, you know, won't that flood the market? Well, no, we're already looking at supply deficits, and now we're looking at a new source of demand. And so I can't vouch for that number, but I was really impressed by the number, something like six of these things. And as you say, the exploration budgets haven't been there. The permitting is getting more difficult. It takes years and years and years, and particularly these big copper projects. I mean, it's one thing to permit a small underground gold mine that really has a small footprint. You can barely see the thing if they put a few trees around it or something. But these giant copper mines, they make mountains turn into valleys. You can't hide that.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of thing that people are protesting more and more around the world. You know what? That mountain's sacred.
You know what? It's a real conflict. On the one hand, they want the copper because they see it as crucial to the Green New Deal. And on the other hand, it's like, how could you dig up nature like that and destroy it? Like, you can't have both.
Right. You can't have both.
Don't just survive. Thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Trilogy Metals is a world-class developer in Alaska's Ambler Mining District. The company already possesses 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, over 1 million gold equivalent ounces, and now over 77 million pounds of cobalt. Trilogy's Arctic project boasts an after-tax net present value of $1.4 billion with a 33% IRR. Trilogy is led by an experienced management team with proven success in discovering and developing projects in Alaska. The company is well capitalized, has no debt, and possesses strong institutional support. Trilogy trades on the New York and Toronto exchanges under the ticker symbol TMQ. To learn more, go to TrilogyMetals.com. That's TrilogyMetals.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Sorry, just to jump in on this as a data point, I just saw a headline about how Rio Tinto and BHP have been working for 26 years to get the Resolution Copper Project into production in Arizona. So, you know, this isn't even some Latin American country that hates mining. This is Arizona. 26 years.
And there's nothing in Arizona once you go out to the major city.
Okay, let's say it is sacred ground to the Navajo, and they're worried about the block cave underground turning their nice desert into a valley. Okay. Then say no, like put these poor guys out of their misery and say that's sacred. We're not going to mine here. Forget it and be done with it. 26 years. And these poor guys are $2 billion on the hook. I mean, that's not how you electrify the future and get us off of fossil fuels.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. And it's so true. And because you can't have both ways. You can't. So, all right, we'll just keep drilling for oil then.
That's right.
We're going to keep drilling for it anyway. That's the deep dirt.
And it's also the same thing for uranium. I don't know if you were going to go there or not, but I think this is actually quite topical to bring into this. You know, if you're seriously concerned about climate change, if you're seriously concerned about climate change, and particularly the 12-year deadline, now 11-year deadline, like this needs to stop in the next 11 years or we're all going to die. Anybody who believes that, you've got to be pro-nuclear. It's just not going to happen without nukes. And I mean, the world is burning more coal now because of what's happened in recent years. If you believe that, you really have to be pro-nuclear. And I bring this up because I think that debate is shifting. More and more pro-environment organizations are reconsidering nuclear. You've got the U.S. administration, their environment ambassador or whatever the hell they call John Kerry. He's out there saying there's no other choice. He gave a talk at MIT telling the engineers to go for it on nuclear energy because there's no choice. So I think this is really another paradigm shift, or at least a tidal shift here, which I think is very important. And the reason why I think this is important to talk about now, Kerry, is because there's a correction in the uranium space. Uranium has been doing this sort of two steps higher, one step low thing really for the last 5 years. And we're in a one step low phase now. Nice background. But the problem was that the uranium stocks had all gotten way ahead of uranium. Uranium's been dropping this year, and the stocks have been riding higher and higher. So, you know, hard to get excited about buying high-priced stocks in a commodity that's falling. But now that's correcting too. And I think I see that as an opportunity. I think it's timely. So for the audience out there, I want you to know, you know, I'm looking hard at buying more uranium stocks, especially if they get cheaper. My most recent new share addition to the portfolio at the Independent Speculator was a uranium play. And this is something I'm very keen on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what you're saying is like totally true. And nuclear power, bad, but we don't want to burn fossil fuels, as they're called. I don't know where they got that name from. I'm kind of not buying into it. But you can't have everything, and you can't have conflicting goals. And the government has been king of this since the first government was formed many years ago. We had it with tobacco. On the one hand, there's the National Institute of Health, smoking bad. On the other hand, there was the Department of Agriculture. Oh, you want to grow tobacco? Have some subsidy.
Yeah.
And finally, the health people won. Maybe it was a bad thing because that led us to COVID and what's happening now. Those people just got too much power. I'm not a proponent of tobacco ingestion in any form. But, you know, like, it shouldn't be subsidized and it shouldn't be banned and overtaxed, right? Libertarians, like, let the market decide if it wants to kill itself or not. But the point is, you can't have both views, all right? You got to pick one. And if they don't want copper in Arizona, they don't want it mined, and I guess it's going to use a lot of water that they don't have and all these other things, then, like you said, just say no. But don't subject these companies to Chinese water torture for a decade or two and have them expend huge sums of money only to get a non-answer. New York is great at this type of thing as well, and many states are. You got to choose your poison, I guess, is what I'm saying. And we don't seem ready to be doing that, right?
Yeah, well, so we could cry rivers over this, but as speculators, you know, the takeaway here is actually positive. To the greater degree governments are gridlocked and tied up, right? You know, because remember, a government isn't a person, it's a group of people, and they're going to have different views. So of course government's going to be inefficient, of course there's going to be contradictions and gridlock. So, you know, that's bad. As a citizen, that's bad. But as a speculator, it means copper prices are going higher. It means that the supply is not going to be there. I can imagine that a future in which whatever happens to the commodity super cycle, whatever happens to inflation, deflation, whatever else happens, when you have a structural and significant supply shortfall, prices go up. And palladium is the perfect example of that, right? Even though the world is trying to move away from burning diesel and gasoline and engines and so on, it just didn't matter. There was not enough of the stuff, and the prices went through the roof. So at the end of the day, the actual scarcity, like real world physical scarcity, trumps politics and everything else.
All right. Well, I think we're going to leave it at that. But write your congressman, tell him you want nuclear power. Write your congressman, tell him you don't want nuclear power. Write him that you want more copper. Write him that you don't. I don't think in the end it's going to matter. I think the economics eventually drive the decision. Politics is in charge of it until the economics become undeniable and until the economics prevail. And eventually the economics will always prevail. I mean, we would all love to have nature all over the place, especially here in Florida. The only thing is we got 22 million people and we got 50,000 people a week or thereabouts, who knows how many, moving down here. They all got to have a place to live. Oh, but then once you build the houses, then they need places to shop, to buy food, clothing, all that. So you got to make your decision. It's one or the other, it's not both. And that's why, even if there's a huge environmental lobby in Florida, and I consider myself part of that, really, there's been destruction done that's just stupid and needless. Eventually, the economics are going to run. They're going to prevail. You're going to get more houses built. You're going to get more retail and offices and all that. Well, I guess offices are kind of passe now, but you know what I'm saying. Workplaces, whatever they might be, you're going to get them. The economics will always prevail in the end. And when they're held back, like with copper and other resources that are vital to life as we know it, then you're going to get hugely exploding prices. Right now, the price of copper, Lobo, $4.30 a pound. It's heading toward its all-time high. When it gets to $10 a pound, if it gets there, and I'm not predicting it because I have no idea, you know, like Yogi Berra said, prediction is really hard, especially when it's about the future. You know, I have no idea, but I do know that when it gets to $7 or $8, the economic forces become unstoppable, and you're going to have copper mines going up in your backyard if there's copper there, or you'll be mining power cables.
You might need guards around your house to prevent people from coming and stealing your copper pipes. But that's the beauty of the situation, Carrie, is even if everything works out exactly as you've said, which I agree with, you can't build a copper mine overnight. I mean, you can bring a few mothballed ones back online, perhaps, but not enough to really make a big difference. We'll be so far behind the eight ball when this happens. It'll take years and years for high prices to cure high prices. And I'm not saying that, you know, when they spike, that it'll stay at some peak. But I would say, and I hate making big, bold predictions, but my expectation is for long-term higher copper prices that are very enduring.
And we could hit a point where it becomes an emergency. And then, you know what they'll do? It's a real simple matter. They'll expedite those permits for those mines, because what is a $2 billion project right now will become a $10 or $20 billion project. And again, economics always prevail. Politics can play games and they create dislocations in the market. But in the end, the market's going to win.
And I think reality matters is another way of saying that. And we got bitch slapped last year. Sorry. Okay. We got a wake up call last year about, you know, if something real is happening, there's some real threat there. I'm really stricken by what was the government's response? What was Operation Warp Speed? What was the government response to a perceived emergency? Whether real emergency or not, you perceive as an emergency, got to do something. What do? They got the government out of the way. They told the private sector, we want vaccines now, go do them, boys. And they did. So I try not to get too optimistic just because, you know, the world has a way of just always going the wrong way. But I just thought that was really, really eye-opening, that when the chips were down and something needed to happen, somebody made a rational decision. It's unpopular to say who, but let's get the government out of the way and let the private sector solve this problem. So yeah, I think you're right. If there's an perceived emergency, like we've got to have this stuff now, ultimately reality matters. And I think you will see the government get out of the way.
Absolutely. And the other alternative is the government creates another TSA to deal with it.
Yeah, but that would prolong the emergency.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll leave it at that. But yeah, when the chips are down, humanity makes the right decision most of the time. And let's hope that it will this time, because it's not just copper, it's nickel, it's zinc, it's so many things that you don't even know that we use that we got to have more of. And policies have stopped it from coming online. Hey, Lobo, just tell us where we go subscribe to the Independent Speculator.
Sure. Thanks for that. And on the last note that you just said, I think that's important, because a rising tide may lift all ships, but they don't necessarily all stay lifted. And not all of the metals and minerals that go into the new energy paradigm are actually in structural supply deficit or looking at supply things. So it's not like go out and buy everything, guys. And I do have a lot of free material at independentspeculator.com. It's meant to be an educational site, an informative site. And we have a free weekly digest that if you sign up for, I promise we will not spam you with a flood of daily advertisements. We don't do that. You get one email a week. And we'll do our best to help you out. Obviously, we hope you'll do business with us in the future. But the answer to your question, Carrie, is actually very simple. Just independentspeculator.com. You can search for various subjects or metals or whatever you're interested in. And there's a lot of free material available right now.
Yeah. Hey, I'm a subscriber. And hey, love what you do. And it's always great having you on the show. Any questions for Lobo, just send an email to my personal address, kl@carrielutz.com. We'll get it over to him and he'll answer it for you. Make sure you sign up for a free newsletter, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Lobo, always great. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, Carrie. Looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network. Now, more than ever.